open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors or design your own using our free garage door designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
This episode of the Squawker Talker is brought to you by Beer 52. Beer 52 is the world's number one craft beer club and delivers crates of hand-picked craft beer to your door. Squawker Talker listeners can get £12 off a crate and two free beers by using the code SQUAWKER at checkout. So if you like a good deal on beer, visit beer52.com.
This week on 101, I'm joined by Brazilian football correspondent for Reuters, Andrew Downey, to talk about new book, Dr. Socrates, Footballer, Philosopher, Legend, which is now available to buy online and in bookstores and is published by Simon & Schuster. Now, thank you very much for coming in for a one-on-one, Andrew. It's a pleasure to have you on. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And so this is the first full first full biography of Socrates. Is there any reason why there hadn't been one before? Because, you know, I was quite surprised at a figure of his stature in the footballing world. You would have assumed at some stage someone would have written one before, or was it or to do with his family, or what was the reason behind that?
The main reason is that up until a couple of years ago in Brazil, biographies had to be authorized. You had to have the permission of the person or his family, his or her family. And that really meant that no one took the chance of writing a biography, because there was a famous case of just a few years ago. There's a famous singer in Brazil called Roberto Carlos, who, not to be confused with the
not that one,
fullback. No. It's funny, people always say that Brazil has two kings, because we have Roberto Carlos, he's known as O Rei, which is the king, and also Pelé is known as O Rei. So Roberto Carlos was really one of the best known faces in Brazil. He's a singer that came around in the 1960s, and he jealously guards his history and his story. And someone wrote a biography of him, and he had it popped. He took them to court and said the story was his. No one else could write it, and it was popped. And that really just showed that it wasn't worth writing a biography of someone unless you had the permission. That law was struck down a couple of years ago, but Brazil is still a very litigious society. So if, for example, someone from the family of the personality wants to sue, they can sue. And that is a big discouragement for anybody who wants to write a book. Now, I have a little bit of a history with Socrates' biography, because I translated originally the Garrincha biography by Rui Castro that came out in about 2005. It's the story of Garrincha, who, as you know, was one of the greatest players of the 50s and 60s. So I translated that for Yellow Jersey, and they came back to me very soon afterwards and asked me if I would like to translate another memoir. And I said, of course, who's it by? And they said, Socrates. And of course, I almost jumped for joy, because, you know, Socrates, who doesn't love Socrates? And I translated it. The problem was, it wasn't a conventional biography or autobiography. It was more a mixture of personal memoir, cultural essays, a little bit of history, quite a bit of philosophy. And there really wasn't a huge, or there wasn't enough about football. There wasn't enough about the matches and the personalities. And I said to Socrates, listen, we should talk, we should discuss this, you should tell me a little bit more about the games and the matches and the big events, and we'll get that into the book and it would become much more attractive. And he said, sure, yeah, okay. However, he had to resolve rights issues with the Italian publisher. He had written this for an Italian publishing house, and he never ever did that. It just never happened. So, you know, every couple of years I'd get an email from him saying, are we going to make this happen? And I'd go, yeah. How'd you get on with Italians? And he said, keep forgetting.
Not so good.
Keep forgetting. Haven't done it yet. And it just, unfortunately, it just never happened. And you know how it is. You know, you keep thinking you've got forever. And then something happens, and Socrates unfortunately passed away in December 2011. And that, you know, just brought that idea to an end. Mm. I always had it in my mind. I always knew that Socrates was an important figure, not just a great football player, but an important personality in football and in Brazil. And it was always in my head to write this biography, and I felt he deserved a biography. And then in 2014, when the World Cup was over, you know, I had time on my hands and I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to go for it. And I went ahead and I started the proposal in the book, and, you know, the rest is history.
Mm. And you also had Johan Cruyff did the foreword for this book. How did that come about?
Well, one of the people I got in touch with, I got in touch with his final wife, his last wife, a woman called Katja, and she was very helpful. She was helpful. His family were also helpful. I spoke to many of his brothers in Ribeirão Preto and in São Paulo. And Katia had been given the foreword by Cruyff, who wrote it for this book that was originally supposed to come out, this book that Socrates wrote. And of course, it never came out. And when I was speaking to her, she said, you know, I have this. This would be great for your book if you want to use it. And I said, fantastic. So I got that, translated it into English. I think she gave it to me either in Dutch or in Portuguese. I can't remember. But she gave it to me. I then went to the Cruyff Foundation and asked the Cruyff Foundation if it was okay. And they took their time. They sort of hummed and hawed and they wanted to make sure, I think, that it was a real Cruyff, that it really was written by Cruyff. And, you know, I sent it to them, and they could see that it obviously was his words. This was after he died, but they gave me permission, and Katja gave me permission, and I think it really adds something to the book, because they were two of the greatest, you know, footballer thinkers that we've ever seen.
Certainly, and obviously for people who, certainly for younger audience, people who probably imagine Socrates probably just by his name, they know who he is. But actually, what was he like as a player? What was his? How did he influence the Brazilian game? He called it was it organized chaos, describing the Brazilian style in comparison to Dutch football. So, just for people who aren't exactly 100% sure what he was like as a player, what was he like?
Well, Socrates was the most unusual of football players, mainly because at the start of his career, he never really trained. He made his debut at the start of the 1970s, right at the same time where he was starting university to study medicine. So his days were spent studying, and his nights, occasionally, he would go over to the club, he'd run a few laps, he'd maybe, you know, play a bounce game. But he never really trained, so he was always very thin. He was always quite fragile. He was very tall. He was about 6'4". He was very skinny. And the effect of this was that he developed the back heel, because he was always afraid of being so weak when he got the ball, a big defender was going to clatter into him, was going to hit him hard, and he would be really hurt. So the first thing that he learned to do was, when he turned professional and played against, you know, full-time players, was as soon as he got the ball, he wanted to lay it off to avoid getting hit. And that really developed the use of the back heel. And he was spectacular with the back heel. Pelé said that he played better facing backwards than most players played facing forwards. So that was one of the most, you know, surprising things of his early career. Mm. You know, then he was just, you know, he was a leader. Most people who know anything about Socrates will remember him from the 82 and 86 World Cups. He was the captain in 82, And he was a real, I kind of liken him to somebody like Bobby Moore or Billy McNeil in Scotland. A player who was the captain, you know, had this unrivaled authority, but not one of these captains who would run around, you know, shaking their fist and getting in people's faces and, you know, urging them on. He led by example. And that is the image that the most people have of him as a player. He was very unhurried. You know, he held his head high. You know, he looked great. Even though he wasn't, you know, particularly good looking, he just sort of looked great. He just was photogenic, and he had this sort of aura about him.
And as you said there, leading by example, you write in the book about how he was a smoker, a bit of a drinker, but in the 1982 World Cup, he decided to quit smoking and carry on. And people actually looked at him and go, "Oh, that's, you know, that's how to do it. That's a real leader there."
Yeah, he was, you know, he started to drink as early in his teens because he lived in a place called Ribeirão Preto, which is in the rural São Paulo, and it's very, very hot in Ribeirão Preto. They joke that there's only two seasons, which is hot and hell. So people drink, as he always said, people drink to keep hydrated. And his family, his father was quite stern, but when he got a drink in him, he was always very social, and he was a well-known member of the community. And he said at weekends, you know, there would always be someone around the house, and his father would lighten up, and his brothers would all drink and have a great time. So he drank early. He started to smoke very early as well. And, you know, this never really left him. He always smoked and he always drank. But he had this one period, as you said, at the start of 1982, where I think he realized that this was his big chance of winning the World Cup. Because Brazil had this, you know, fantastic team. The players were all at their peak. They had, you know, the famous midfield, as you probably recall, is Falcão. There was Toninho Cerezo. There was Zico, and there was Socrates in midfield, and they were all kind of in their mid to late 20s. So they were all playing at their peak, and Socrates really wanted to get into shape. This one time, he said, you know, this is like the one time in my life I'm going to ditch the cigarettes. I'm going to ditch the beer and I'm going to train, because I know that if I do this and we get it right, then we can win the World Cup. And, you know, there's a quote in the book from Zico saying that they were, you know, they would train. First of all, Socrates, he threw up several times, because the training before the World Cup back then, it was different from now. They would have several months in which to train. I think they met in April, and they had the whole of April, the whole of May, and parts of June to prepare for the World Cup. It's not like now where you get a couple of weeks. So it was almost like a pre-season, and Socrates would throw up. The training was so hard. But Zico said, you know, he would, you know, he dedicated himself to getting ready and getting fit. And they would joke with him, you know, because they knew that he didn't like to train. And they'd say, "What's this? Socrates at the start at the, you know, running, doing laps, you know, what's going on here? Something's amiss."
This casual man, yes. So that was his peak as a player then? The 82?
Definitely for the national team, yeah. But his peak overall was probably that period between 82, 83, 84, the start of 84. It was also the period where that coincided with Corinthians' democracy, which I'm sure we'll get into in a second.
But
I don't think that's really any coincidence. I think the two things are very closely related.
And in terms of style, if you could compare him to a player in today's game, who might that be, if that's possible?
I don't know. I think the game has just changed so much. I don't think there's room for a player like Socrates anymore, because he was quite, I don't want to say lackadaisical, he was quite relaxed. He joked that he, you know, he never ever sprinted on a football pitch. He was just very laid back. He was that kind of player that just doesn't.
A bit like a Berbatov or Ibrahimovic sort of in there.
I would think it's when I think of him, I always the person I think of, and this is a real kind of throwaway. But I think of somebody like Riquelme, who was, you know, who had all this talent in his feet, but just really never moved very far. You know, and he was really slow, and. That's probably not fair to Socrates or to Riquelme, but he was that kind of player that he had great vision. He could make killer passes, and he could also get into the box. He was a lot like Zico in that sense, even though they looked completely different. Zico was compact and sort of buzzing around, but they would both come and go from the penalty box. One of the managers at the time compared him to Tostão, which was quite a good comparison, because Tostão in the 1970 World Cup was kind of the prototype, you know, false number nine. You know, playing as a centre forward, but dropping back whenever he needed to, creating as much as he scored, and that was what Sócrates was like as well. He could play in and out the box. He did a lot of his great work, you know, through passes, through his vision, and I don't think these players exist quite so much anymore. Sócrates, for example, never tracked back to mark. That just didn't exist back then.
You don't think it limited him? In a sense that he didn't quite run around as much as Zico would, for example.
No, because that was the way they played then. I mean, you could go, and if you were a left winger, you would stand on the left wing and wait for the ball. If you were, you know, the fullback, you know, you wouldn't push over the halfway line. I mean, it was just a different kind of. I'm being a little bit, I'm maybe exaggerating a little bit. Obviously, the 82 team had fullbacks who pushed up and all this kind of stuff. But generally, your role was much more limited. You weren't expected to track back. You weren't expected to run, you know, for 90 minutes. If you were the creative guy, you waited for the ball to come to you in the middle of the park, and then you did something with it. You made something happen. And that's exactly what he did. You know, they got the ball to him, and he made things happen.
And he didn't go on to win the World Cup. And famously, that team, you know, the greatest team that didn't manage it. But how did that affect him as a person and his career following that? He went to Fiorentina, but beyond that, do you think that was kind of affected him psychologically?
Well, the interesting thing is that he, throughout that 1982 World Cup, he was in two minds about whether he was enjoying himself or not. He at this point, he was quite sophisticated at this point. He had really grown, really learned. He had really become, you know, kind of a citizen of the world. And he was looking forward to the World Cup to meet other players, to meet fans, to take part in this kind of worldwide jamboree. And again, remember, it was 1982. You never really saw, if you were from Brazil, you never really saw European teams and vice versa. And you certainly never saw teams from Africa or Asia. They appeared once every 4 years. And he was looking forward to this big event. And really, he spent the whole time cooped up with the Brazil team and was quite disappointed at it all. He was quite disillusioned that he never got to see more of the world and meet more people. And he said during that World Cup, you know, this is it. This is the only World Cup I'm going to. It's been a bit of a disappointment because I've not really seen the world. I'm not doing it again, he said. You know, maybe I'll watch it on the telly with my wife and kids in 4 years' time, but that's it. And then as soon as Brazil lost, the next again day, the players were out by the pool. They were the first thing they did the next again day was sit by the pool and drink as much beer as they possibly could, because they hadn't been able to drink for weeks beforehand, months beforehand. So they sat by the pool and said, led by Zico, listen, we're coming back for 4 years. You know, we're really disappointed at this defeat by Italy. We didn't deserve to lose.
What was the reaction from the Brazilians back at home to that defeat?
Surprisingly enough, it was quite muted. I think the Brazilians back home realised that there was it was unlucky. More than anything, it was unlucky. There were some complaints that they maybe should have played for a draw, because Brazil only needed to draw to go through. There was a few complaints that they could have just played for a draw. There was a few isolated criticism of Toninho Cerezo for the second Italy goal. Some people said Serginho was a weak link. Some people said Valdir Perez in goal was the weak link. But most of the criticism was quite muted, especially compared to today when you know, Brazil go out, you know, it's like the world has ended. I think everyone realised that the 82 team had played some of the nicest football and were unlucky not to go further.
Now, you've brought an extract to read. Can you just explain the sort of the context behind this and where we are in the book?
Right, the extract I've got is just a page from about the 1986 World Cup. Arriving in Mexico, and it explains the headband, we all, probably the best image that we have of Socrates is the one of him standing at the 1986 World Cup wearing the headband. And for anybody who doesn't know, it's at the start of the 1986 World Cup, Socrates appeared for the first game with a headband. And he appeared at subsequent matches with a headband. All the headbands had different slogans on them. One said no to terror, which was in response to the US bombing of Libya. Another one said love. Another one said justice. And this first headband, the snippet I'm going to read for you now describes how those came about and what was said on that first headband, which I add is the cover of the book.
Sure, yes, let's hear it.
The 1986 World Cup was originally planned for Colombia, but it was moved to Mexico in 1983 after financial and political problems forced the Colombians to withdraw. However, in the early hours of 19th September 1985, the tournament's future was thrown into jeopardy once more when a massive earthquake rocked Mexico City. At least 10,000 people died and large parts of the city were destroyed. And even though the Mexican government insisted the tournament would go ahead as planned, there was widespread concern over whether it was right to spend money on football, while hundreds of thousands of homeless and hungry people were still trying to put their lives back together. Brazil arrived in Mexico City 8 months later, but the damage was still extensive. And as he drove in from the airport, Socrates could not have missed the flattened buildings, the rubble-strewn lots, and the pavements that rose and fell like waves. Socrates felt an instant solidarity with the Mexican people, and he wanted to make some sort of statement. He tossed ideas over in his head, but he couldn't quite work out what to do. Then one night, as he lay on his bed flicking through the Mexican TV channels, a little girl in a tiara appeared on the screen in front of him. It was a eureka moment, and he scribbled a few words on a sock and wrapped it around his head to see what it looked like. The prototype was good enough, and the next day he went in search of someone who could make a proper headband with his message on it. The slogan he chose for the opening match against Spain was Mexico, sigue en pie, or Mexico, stand tall, and the Mexicans appreciated his gesture of solidarity. His teammates, however, were none the wiser. He hadn't told anyone what he planned to do, not Zico, not Captain Eginho, not even his best mate Casagrande, and he slipped the headband on as he was walking up the tunnel. The photographs of Socrates with the headband below his unkempt mane of hair would become one of the most iconic images in World Cup history. The picture of his face, scowling slightly through his trademark beard, was reminiscent of the famous photo of Che Guevara, and it became one of the enduring images of an already photogenic career.
And so off the pitch, Socrates was a political activist, had a real passion for politics. Why do you think he was so in tune with these matters? I mean, it's not something that most footballers are traditionally known for. I mean, someone who lists Che Guevara, John Lennon and Karl Marx as his heroes. How did that first come about?
Well, contrary to what a lot of people believe, it took a long time to come about. Socrates is often seen as a lifelong socialist, and that's really not true. He studied at university, and Brazil was in the midst of a military dictatorship. It was the right-wing military took over in 1964 in a coup d'etat. He went to university in 1972, and that coincided with the worst years of the dictatorship. There was a lot of repression in the late 60s and early 70s. But Socrates really tried hard not to get involved in politics at that point. You know, he was studying, he was playing football. He had a wife and a kid in the late 74, early 75. So he had an awful lot on his plate. And his friend said he made he had no interest in politics. What really changed was he arrived in Sao Paulo in 1978. And at the start of the 80s, he began to meet more people. Sao Paulo is Brazil's biggest city, so it's where there's a great cultural life. It's where a lot of the politics happens. Socrates was the biggest star at the city's biggest club. So everybody wanted to know him, and he got to know a lot of people. His eyes were basically opened. Two of the main people that were his biggest influences were a guy called Juca Kifuri, who was the editor of the main sports magazine, football magazine at the time, and a guy called Adilson Montero Alves, who was the director of football at Corinthians at the time, and they were both quite leftist, and they spoke to him. They basically schooled him and instructed him on what was actually going on in Brazil at the time. They talked about this dictatorship. They talked about the repression. They talked about the abuse. And he didn't know a lot about it at the time, and that really opened his eyes. And that's when he really started to become, you know, more politically active.
And so how did he bring politics into football? What was the Corinthians democracy movement that he founded?
Corinthians democracy started at the end of 81, the beginning of 82, and it coincided with the arrival of Adilson Montero Alves at the club. He, as I said, was quite a leftist, and he wanted the democracy to end, the dictatorship to end. The dictatorship was kind of on its last legs at this point, and he wanted to use the football club to help hasten its demise. And so Adilson got the players together. He knew Socrates was a big personality. He knew Socrates kind of thought the same way as he did. He knew Socrates was conscientious and was clever. And so together they put together the thing called Corinthians Democracy. And what Corinthians Democracy was, it was essentially the football players running the club. It was one man, one vote. So every player got a vote, and that didn't matter if you were the Brazil captain or the reserve left back. You got one vote. The kit man got a vote. The physiotherapist got a vote. The trainer got a vote. And they would vote on everything that involved the day-to-day running of the club. And that included who to sign, how long to train, whether to stop the coach coming back from an away game for a pee or a drink. And so it was essentially the players running the club. And that would be revolutionary at any club, at any time. But it was extraordinarily revolutionary in 1982 Brazil, which was still in the midst of this military dictatorship. And the military, of course, didn't like this, in large part because it was Socrates and football players talking to the people about things like democracy, representation, freedom of speech. And most people at that point really had no experience with these concepts. And so it was a threat to the military. And Socrates and the Corinthians players took it to the people and basically opened their eyes. And that was a huge deal. And it's something that has, quite simply, it's never, ever been repeated at any major football club, even to this day.
So what is the legacy then at Corinthians now? Do they still, when, how long did that go on for, and how is that remembered at Corinthians?
Well, it went on until Socrates left Corinthians in 1984, in May 1984, when he went to Italy. It kind of continued a little bit after that, but it really died away in 1985, in large part because Socrates was the face of the movement. And once the movement lost its biggest personality, it made it harder to keep going. There was internal politics at the club as well that didn't help, but Socrates' departure was a big blow to the movement.
Was he ever considering a kind of a serious move into mainstream politics into Brazilian parliament at all or not?
Well, at that point, no. At that point, Socrates made a point of not getting involved in party politics. He did get a little bit involved in politics towards the end of his career. He was the sports secretary in Ribeirão Preto, the town where he grew up. And he did that for a year or two, and he quite enjoyed it. And then the local, the Workers' Party, which was led by Lula, who became a friend of his, they tried to get him to run for deputy for parliament. And he, first of all, said yes, and then very quickly realized what this was going to involve, because there was nothing worse in Socrates' life than long meetings with people in suits, you know. He enjoyed, his idea of a meeting was sitting in his Bermuda shorts and his flip-flops with a bunch of people in a whole crate, you know, a freezer full of beer. That was the way he got things done. He would sit and he would talk to people that way, and he would get things done. But he realized that politics was just going to really bore him, and he didn't have the patience for it. And he once said at the end of his career, he said, "I love politics, but I hate political parties." And I think that really summed up his his vision of it better than anything.
Was the activist in him. But so Brazil held the World Cup in 2014. Obviously, it was a great tournament for most people. But beforehand, it was not popular, was it? And there were protests. What would Socrates have thought of that? Would he have backed it, or would he have joined the protesters himself?
Well, Socrates, you know, spoke out about the World Cup. You know, Brazil were awarded the World Cup in I think it was 2007, and so he had a few years to discuss it, and he was right on the button as usual. You know, he said, you know, if it's done properly and it's done as a way of helping people, of putting in infrastructure, of building stadiums for the clubs, of taking this to the people and not just it being a big free-for-all for construction companies, for FIFA, for the CBF, the Brazilian Football Confederation, then, you know, then great. But, you know, I think he knew deep down that that was not what was not the way it was going to happen. And he was right. You know, we have all these stadiums that were built. A lot of them were white elephants, you know, over budget, cost a fortune. A lot of the infrastructure projects that were really the whole raison d'etre of doing the World Cup, they were never built. You know, the government said they would build a metro here and a new airport there, and it just never happened. And he, with his experience, he knew this was likely and was never a big fan of it all happening.
And the legacy of that that World Cup, what is happening now? Is it still things being left to sort of go derelict, and or is there actual planning involved, or what's happened since?
No, I mean it's a bit of a mess. I mean, the best example is the Maracanã. I mean, it's one of the greatest football stadiums in the world, and the last time there was a game there was the end of December, and throughout January and February it was just left to rot. The people who were supposed to be running it weren't running it. There was a big legal battle over who should be running it because nobody wanted to take it over. And during these 2 months, thieves went in and stole copper. They stole the bust of Mario Filho, who was the journalist after whom the stadium was named. It's called the Maracanã, but it's really the Estádio Mario Filho. Seats were torn out. The turf, just because it wasn't looked after, it just became all rutted and burnt, and it just withered away. And that's probably the best example of just how authorities have just let things go to seed, and it's a huge tragedy. It's a similar sort of situation in other stadiums elsewhere, such as in Cuiabá is the worst example. I mean, there's no first or second or third division club in Cuiabá, and yet they built a 45,000-seater stadium. It was madness, and everybody could see it was madness, but it still happened.
Yes. So ordinary Brazilians, how do they see Socrates now? Is he still revered as a footballer as well as being revered as a sort of political activist in his own right?
Yeah, I think really what makes Socrates such a great subject for a biography and what makes him special is that he is, I can't think of any other top-class footballer who was more important off the field than he was on it. He really transcended football. And, you know, for that reason, he holds a real special place in people's hearts, especially people who were around in the 1980s and who remember him taking on such a vocal role in fighting the dictatorship. And for that reason alone, I think he holds a real special place in a lot of Brazilians' hearts.
And did your opinion of him change whilst writing the book?
That's a good question. Did it change? No, I don't think in general it changed. I think, I always knew how important he was. I lived in Brazil a long time, so I knew a lot of the background. The real thing that surprised me was how long it took him to come to his political awakening. Somebody sent me a tweet once just after just before the book came out, saying, "I hope you won't." You know, this is quite a lefty guy, and said, "You know, I hope you won't whitewash his lifelong dedication to socialism." And I didn't respond, but I thought, "You're in for a surprise," because that lifelong dedication to socialism really only came about at the start of the 80s when he was, you know, almost 30 years old. So in the early part of his career, he was quite he was quite supportive of the military. And I think that'll surprise a lot of people. And it was fascinating to me you know, how he made that transition, how he was supportive of the military, and then how he sort of moved away from it, how he met people, how he opened up, how he...
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.